to the First Arts Activated, brought to you every 4 weeks on 2RPH. It's also a podcast that you can subscribe to via all major apps. Every episode, we're going to meet professional artists who live with disability and take a deep dive into a current theme while discussing their work. I'm your host, Anthea Williams. I'm a film and theatre director, and you can find out more about my work on www.antheawilliams.net. Of course, the disability community has been particularly affected by the pandemic. So today we're talking all things lockdown. Later in the show, I'll be talking about the 2020 exhibition with artists Paul Colcott, Geoffrey Wood and Alison Reynolds. But first up, one of my favourite TV series this year was ABC's Retrograde. So I'm going to talk to lead writer Anna Barnes and actor Esther Hannaford, who both worked on the show. So first of all, I just want to say thank you both for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, cool. My first question is, I'm going to just say to Anna, tell us a little bit about the show.
Okay, so Retrograde is a 6-part comedy series on the ABC, which is all available to binge on iView right now. So the show's about a character called Maddie and her group of friends, who are all 30-somethings, who decide to create an online bar during COVID, so when the first lockdown happens, because they want to hang out and drown their sorrows together. So it kind of follows their lives over a period of around, 6 weeks.
And tell me a little bit about how you came up with the idea for this and how it was made.
So this was Meg O'Connell and Mark O'Toole, the creators, and they came up with the idea. Meg had actually created an online bar with Dan Lake, who was one of the producers. So when COVID, so early March, I think it was around then, before the lockdown was officially brought in, they were, like many of us, quite concerned and decided to isolate. So yeah, Meg and Dan created an online bar and just invited their friends, and they all just started hanging out. So it actually was quite true to life, the beginning of it. And then they invited Mark O'Toole, who's a writer, and he came to the bar, and they realised that they had a show on their hands. So they invited ABC to the bar and they pitched their idea. And within 3 months of that initial pitching, the TV show was on air. So it was a super quick turnaround.
That is an insanely fast turnaround. Like, usually you're proud if you get your show on air in 3 years. That's just remarkable.
Yeah.
And Esther, being in the show meant that you actually had to invite people into your home in a way, didn't it?
Yes. This was the set. So I had one tech op that was here the whole time, and then people coming in and out, sort of dressing the set. But mainly it was just the one, me and my kitty. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've got to say, I identified with this show and with Sophie in particular, which was your character, Esther, probably more than any other show I've seen on telly in years. And that was partly because Sophie is a woman who lives with chronic illness. And I just felt like it spoke to me and my experience of, showing a resilient woman who is dealing with a lot. Can you tell me a little bit about how you two work together to create Sophie?
It's Anna's character for sure. But because I related so much because of my Crohn's, and it just, how did we do it, Anna? I don't really know what to say.
Well, can I just interrupt here and say what's been really lovely about this is while you're saying that it's Anna's character, Anna's there shaking your head going, no, it's your character.
So, I know, I was going to say, Esther is being very, very generous there. I think Sophie really was a creation that, yeah, it came up in the writer's room, but Esther brought so much to Sophie, and we had so many long phone calls between us kind of discussing the character, discussing both of our kind of experiences of living with chronic illness, and that really worked its way into the character. So it was such a joy and a real privilege for me to be able to work with an actor that has the lived experience of chronic illness, and it made it so much better, so much easier for me as a writer, because I wasn't having to, we have such a shorthand because we both have experienced so much the world, but also within the medical community. And so, yeah, it was a real pleasure to be able to work with Esther on Sophie.
Yes, likewise. I remember when I went to the audition and they were like, don't know if it's going to, she sounds like angry or something like that. And I was like, to me, it was all just very matter of fact because this is our life. This is what we all deal with. I wasn't, you know, trying to get pity or, you know, anything like that. So I think that's why I just love doing it. And I'm glad that I got to do it or someone in the chronic, illness or disability community got to do it because, yeah, those things are important that we're not all super sad all the time and non-functioning, like we're all doing things and coping and managing. And she had the best lines. She had the best comedy lines. I was like, yes.
She actually did.
So good.
Yeah, she absolutely did. And I almost felt when I was watching it that, because, you know, I actually didn't know anything about the character before I started watching. And I really quickly was aware in the first episode that I was watching something quite different to an audience member who didn't live with a chronic illness. I was really aware that you just released information in such an interesting way that I knew that there was more going on with Sophie than probably what someone who didn't live with chronic illness would have known. Was that a plan?
It wasn't entirely, but I know exactly what you mean. There are a lot of Easter eggs throughout, and whether that be from like the Annie Sigaras t-shirt that she's wearing in episode 2, it wasn't on purpose. It just came about because she's with a group of friends. She's not going to be explaining, you know, her life or what's going on. And so we were just trying to work out how do we make it so it doesn't feel like, this is the moment that we explain the illness. You know, how do we drop this stuff in a way that feels relatable to people who experience it, but then doesn't alienate people who don't? So they don't, I mean, I don't think people watching it would have known all the little bits that they're not picking up on, which is kind of the best way to do it. But yeah, so it just kind of came about because it was just talking about the ways that we do talk about our illness on an everyday basis. It's not new to us, so it wasn't new to Sophie.
I think the show did a really good job of unpacking some of the stereotypes around disability. We've all seen the character who is unwell, so therefore doesn't have a life. But Sophie seemed to be the coolest and she seemed to have the most going on. Like, because this show was set in your living room, you were constantly on the phone. You were constantly talking to other people. And it was really aware that she had multiple communities of friends. Can you just talk to me a little bit about how you wanted to structure that?
We always talked about the sick internet and that she was kind of COVID proof. So her life, she already was very well set up for COVID to happen in that she's got a online communities happening. So her life, I just wanted to make sure that she was, you know, very active in that world. And this was kind of like, yeah, you guys are here and that's great. But I've still, as always, got this whole other world and community happening. What about you, Anna?
Yeah, exactly that. I think that so many of us have spent such, you know, long periods of time in our house because of illness. We do, like, I definitely do have a very active online presence in, not so much on social media or anything, but more just I engage with, you know, friends or work. And so, yeah, whenever we say sick internet on Retrograde, we're really kind of discussing the kind of online communities that exist. So whether it's kind of the Facebook groups of the different conditions or Twitter or Instagram, but basically those spaces are really active. And so I wanted Sophie to kind of reflect that. She's, you know, she's got watching parties, she's got different groups of people that she's hanging out with. So yeah, that was kind of a very big part of her life, because I think for a lot of young people with chronic illness, the internet is a massive part of our lives. It was important for me that it showed that she had already adapted, and the pivot that I guess mainstream society has done over the last few months had already been done by Sophie a long time ago.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And it's wonderful when she takes that back to her friends at the end. You know, there's a moment in one of the final episodes where she talks about what the pandemic has been like for her as opposed to what it's been like for them. And I thought it was a really remarkable moment. I imagine that was really fun to perform, Esther.
Yeah, it was. I guess those moments, because she'd been so kind of accommodating really the whole time. So it was nice to have a moment where I could actually just speak that truth. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. it was really clear that we were watching a character who was further down a journey than the rest of her friends who were dealing with the pandemic in a different way because they hadn't had to deal with illness, whereas in some ways during the pandemic we were all made to deal with illness.
Yeah, exactly.
I think one of the most powerful moments for me in the series was when Trump tweeted about Plaquenil.
Yes, hydroxychloroquine, yes.
So
it's a big day.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about writing that moment into the script?
Yeah, definitely. So I was on Plaquenil, which is, the drug that Trump had decided was the cure or the I don't know, his kind of golden drug to fight COVID. And I recently stopped Plaquenil, but as soon as I saw it, I mean, it was I think the main thing that I've experienced during this global pandemic is just how strange it is to hear people talk about things that we're used to talking about in small communities. So to hear on the news people talking about Plaquenil was just like, I mean, it just blew my mind because I was so used to that just being, you know, this drug that I took that no one knew about. But yeah, no, I thought it was really scary. Luckily for me, I had gone off it about maybe 12 months ago. But yeah, I thought it was really, I could see like in the community on Sick Internet, people being very, very concerned about being able to access the drug. From my understanding, they actually in Australia had to bring in some restrictions because so many doctors and dentists randomly, I think, were prescribing it to friends and family. So there was such a moment of fear and panic. And also not just for people who were on Plaquenil, but I think for everyone who is on drugs that either keep them alive or just keep them, you know, upright or well, that fear of realizing, wow, this is going to be a really rough time and we're going to be facing a lot of challenges that we hadn't thought. So yeah, I found it it felt like that was something that we definitely wanted to put in. It also just illustrated the different kind of stakes that the characters are all experiencing. And throughout, there are kind of different stakes. We have a character that has a child, so she's dealing with being a single parent. You know, there's a character who is unemployed and he's going through the stress of trying to get Centrelink on the phone. So, everyone's kind of facing different things throughout the pandemic. And that was something that, we felt like it was important to just highlight that a lot of people are struggling to be able to look after their health because some, I don't know, I won't swear, but
tangerine idiot,
some drongo who happens to be the president of the United States decided to tweet something that was, you know, not only irresponsible, but from my understanding, medically untrue. Felt like it was something that should definitely be in there.
I think it was a really interesting moment, and it was when you realised that Sophie was leading a very different life from her other kind of 30-something friends. Yeah, Thank you so much for coming on. It was absolutely brilliant talking to you both, and congratulations for making such a brilliant show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We really appreciate all the support that we've got from chronic illness communities and disability. It's really meant the world to all of us, to everyone involved in the show.
Retrograde is a brilliant show, and you can stream all 6 episodes on ABC iView. For those just tuning in, this is Anthea Williams on Activated Arts. Now, from television to the 2020 exhibition. I'm joined by artists Paul Colcott and Geoffrey Wood and project manager Alison Reynolds, part of the 2020 exhibition, a project that will be online from the 22nd of October and aims at being radically accessible. I'll talk a little bit with Alison about that towards the end of the interview, but first up, I want to talk to our artists, Paul and Jeff. Paul is a Wiradjuri elder, he's a member of the LGBTIQ+ community, and he's a renowned artist who's worked across Australia, Canada and Aotearoa. He's presented his work at the UN, both in Geneva and New York, as part of work supporting LGBTIQ+ First Peoples living with disability and high highlighting the issues and barriers related to this. Geoffrey Wood is an activist and artist. His sculptural work is often made from found materials, and his interest in science viewed through the lens of art saw him visit the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Alison has used her technical and management artistic skills to create 2020, an online exhibition of work by renowned artists living with disability. I'm really pleased to have you all here. Thank you very much for joining me. Paul, I've seen a couple of your artworks and I think they're absolutely remarkable. I love the work you've made, Seven Spirit. It's a work that's going to be part of the exhibition, and it looks at how there are seven genders in some cultures. And I know that in various cultures around the world, particularly First Nation cultures, there's a really long, ancient understanding of gender being more than binary. It's an absolutely beautiful work. Can you tell me a little bit about creating it?
Well, it came about just because we've been doing some work. I presented an artwork at the New York on Seven Spirits and the barriers that LGBTIQ plus First Nations people with disabilities have to deal with. And I was just sitting here in between some commissions and I was talking to a colleague whose son is non-binary. And I just thought, you know, I really just wanted to do this little painting just about a non-gender person and how the seven spirits coincides with the LGBTIQ plus and the seven colours of the rainbow. If you put a black colour in for culture, impacts on somebody. So it's just a painting of a person who's non-specific gender, but how all these spirits influence them. So it's sort of like a spectrum where, you know, these spirits influence your life. So it's just something I really wanted to do. And I also wanted to put in down in the corner represents elders sitting around and talking, and it's part of our dreaming. Because in all my research, I haven't been able to find any negative dreaming stories about LGBTIQ plus in our culture. In fact, a lot of art symbols ask the question, was our culture all over this gender-neutral stuff long before anyone else started talking about it, like 40,000 years ago? Because the symbol used to represent a person, you actually have to augment it to make it male or female. The Min Min spirits are gender-neutral. Our Biomi, who is like our creator, is gender-neutral. So I just wanted to do a painting that sort of told that story. And when the exhibition came up, I just thought, what a great opportunity to put it out there publicly. So it just all fell into place.
It's a really beautiful artwork, and I'm really pleased it's going to be available to the public for such a long time through 2020. Do you want to tell me a little bit about your other piece that's going to be in the exhibition? I believe that's called Long Grass.
Yes, that's so when I travel through, I have the huge opportunity with my job to travel out to remote communities to talk about disabilities and sit down with community. And I always find just on dusk and traveling through that just the way the grasses change colour in the desert landscape, really quite amazing. They sort of, you know, there's a breeze, it'll blow, and they just take on this beautiful silvery colour of the nighttime. And so that was just something I wanted to do as a representation of just travelling through country and the long grasses. And sometimes, you know, it's where people do go and stay and conduct ceremony and that as well. It's a lot of secret stuff going on. But I just wanted to depict something, you know, the landscape of the desert and that as well, and different countries I travel through.
That's beautiful. Geoff, the work of yours I've seen seems very closely related to the pandemic. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that?
I think my motivation is slightly different in a way. I was looking at the tension that seemed to be apparent with science and economics. I was also in isolation, of course, and the materials that were coming through the house as a consumer, and I was looking at the purchasing of this and the economic weight of that and materiality of buying from Woolies and these places.
Geoff has made a wonderful work. Geoff's work is often very sculptural, and he has crafted a mask. And it seems to me that it's a mask made out of metal. Geoff, do you want to tell our audience a little bit more about your process around creating this work and the work that you've created for 2020?
Yeah, the method involved me using captured tin. That material had this wonderful texture about it, immediately brought feeling of it having a higher value than what it actually has. I felt that I could experiment with that, and I found that I could weave a mesh out of that and then copied the N95 mask as a way to sort of bring emphasis to the face mask as one of the defences that we have.
Can I just say that, Geoff, your masks are amazing, brother. I who'd have thought a mask would become a status symbol, but also just a way of walking around with an art installation on your face. I just think it's incredible.
I completely agree with that, Paul. It is absolutely remarkable. Alison, in many ways, you are the person who's brought us all together. You're the project manager of this exhibition, 2020, which is going to go live from the 22nd of October. So you've taken the pandemic and realised that this is a great time to get art online and make something radically accessible. I would love to hear more about your thinking behind this project.
Again, we were just talking then about how things have been topsy-turvy, and it really has been one of those things where exhibitions, you go to a place, you go to a space, you stand there and you look at something, and now that's just not on, and you know, can actually be dangerous to people. So when we started putting this exhibition together, we were looking at, well, what's the best way to reach the most amount of people without losing too much of what art is? So we said, well, obviously online is the solution, but how can we do this so that it reaches as many people as possible? We decided that we would make it a two-part site. One would be the normal things that you would normally see on a website. You'd see images and some writing and links. And the other part you can choose to go into is more of a virtual experience within the virtual space. You can't, with Access, as we all know, you can't please all of the people all the time, but we can make it so that people have more, using the NDIS term, choice and control about how they experience this art. So with the accessibility, in what we say is the relaxed side of things, there's audio description, there is actual text description, there's minimal video, but there is lots and lots of ways of experiencing the art that is sort of chosen for the person. There's close-ups, there's in some cases the reverse of something. Jeff's work being 3D, we'll have a rotating video of his mask. We wanted to make it easy to experience. And on the other side, with the 3D side of things, you have more control. So it means that things like a screen reader won't be able to access the actual things in there, but things are changing all the time, so that might be fixed by the time, by October the 22nd. But yeah, you get to drive, well, actually fly. You get to fly around into each artist's cube and view their art up close, far away, you know, like you would in a gallery.
I think that's really exciting, Alison. And I love that image of flying. We haven't had a chance to talk about all the ways which you're making sure that this work is accessible, but I think it's fantastic that it's been built into the exhibition from the very beginning. It's been wonderful to talk to all three of you today. Thank you so much for coming on board. 2020 will be live on www.2020exhibition.art from the 22nd of October, and it will be live on that website for 12 months.
So now is one of my favourite parts of the show. Each time I'm going to be talking to Liz Martin, who's the Development Manager at Accessible Arts. I'm going to chat to her about what's coming up that she's excited about. So Liz is a lover of all things art, and she is also a musician. Hey Liz, can you tell us a little bit about your music practice?
Oh no, that's the question I hate the most. It's like, what is your 30-second elevator pitch? I don't know. I've been really influenced by all sorts of music, from folk music to rock, jazz, pop, what was called world music in the 90s. I don't know. I take all those things that I love and create my own sort of sound. Probably the best way to understand it is to listen to it, and you can hear it on all your different music platforms. My favorite is Bandcamp, because it pays the musicians a decent rate, or you can check it out on my website, which is lizmartin.com.au.
That's awesome. So Liz, in terms of arts projects that people can be audiences for, what are you excited about at the moment?
I am as truly excited about the Archibald and the great representation of people with disability in this year's finalist round. This is the first time we've seen two artists with Down syndrome, both truly well-recognized people within the disability arts community. And, of course, I'm speaking about Emily Crockford and Digby Webster. Their work is so fun and engaging and well worth checking out. Emily Crockford, her work is called Self-Portrait with Daddy and the Daisies, Watching the Field of Planes. And it's in honour of her father who passed away in January 2020. She talks about it being a selfie with memories of her dad. It's bright and colourful and playful. So she's made it at Studio A, but she's also worked on it at her home studio. She calls the studio Emily's Studio with Museum Planes. And it was originally her father's workshop where he used to build model planes that he'd then fly. And lots of those planes are still hanging in the studio. Her work is out on the street. She does lots of public art. You can check it out on the Studio A website. The other artist with disability in this year's Archibald Prize finalists is, of course, Digby Webster and his collaborative piece with Neil Tompkins called Ernest Brothers. Neil and Digby have been collaborating for years. They share the middle name Ernest, and their work is just beautiful, fun, playful, and well worth checking out as well. So I can't recommend these enough. You can see them online. You can go to the Art Gallery of New South Wales here in Sydney and check out the work by Emily Crockford and Digby Webster.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for that.
Yeah, Anthea, so what are you excited about? Who are you going to be checking out this week?
I'm really excited about Down the Line, which is an exhibition by Adam Napper. And Adam is a Melbourne-based artist. His work is available online at the moment, and it really ties in with our pandemic theme. He's doing these drawings of beautiful interweaving and interlocking ribbons. He's looking at how people are connected during the COVID pandemic. It's about contact. It's very human. It's very ethereal. And I just think it's absolutely beautiful. That work is available through the Arts Access website.
Fabulous.
I think we're done. Thanks for joining me for the first Activated Arts show. Our next show will be live on the 6th of November. And not only will we be talking to writers Fiona Wright and Anna Jacobson, but they'll also be reading us some of their work. And if you don't want to tune in at a particular time, you can also subscribe to this show as a podcast. Now, I was going to end the show by playing you a little bit more of brilliant Sydney artist Akenyo's track, Eyes to the Sky, which I gave you a tiny sample of, but you're just going to have to wait till next time for that. Esther Hannaford and Anna Barnes thought you should hear something completely different, which was me trying to say the name of a medication that a certain president has not taken, despite insinuating it was some kind of wonder drug. I'm going to say that again. When Trump tweeted about
okay, but we all went through it.
Okay, can someone say
hydroxychloroquine?
Hydroxychloroquine, that's it.
Hydroxychloroquine. Yes. I think one of the most powerful moments for me was when Trump tweeted about hydroxychloroquine. Now, tell me.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I think there was a chloroquine joke. Yeah. I don't know if it made it, but that's how you could.
I'm going to try one more time, and if not, I'm just going to make you say a line for me, Anna, so I can edit that in later. I think one of the most powerful moments was when Trump tweeted about hydroxychloroquine. No, fuck.